from KALW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll hear the story of why 27 homeless people in San Francisco are no longer camping under the freeway.
One of them told me, said, my day started off the day better than it did yesterday.
Then we'll continue our conversations about the treatment of California inmates found suitable for parole. We'll have a response from the state to inmate Richard Gilliam's most recent allegations that his case has been mishandled.
Everything that he needs to know by the time he goes out the door, he already knows, and he knew it before he wrote the letter to you.
And we'll talk with the leader of a Baptist church in Oakland about solutions to the cycle of violence.
When black people think of law enforcement, they are thinking about the enemy.
That's coming up today on an extended edition of Cross Currents. Over the past 8 months, Caltrans in the city of San Francisco have been periodically sweeping people out of an encampment under the 280 on-ramp at 5th and King, just west of AT&T Park. Each time, the community of homeless campers, including Ian Smith, would return.
Sandra and Tomas, the couple over there, sat there and basically made a home, you know, back there. And yeah, there was flowers and, you know, a little, you know, rock garden and everything like that. It was really, really nice.
Last year, Caltrans promised to build a fence in January to keep people out. They got around to doing that last week. But first, the public health department, the police, and other city officials teamed up to move the nearly 30 people camping there, first to a church shelter and then to rooms in residency hotels. KALW's Mary Reese reports.
Last fall, I went to 5th and King Streets in San Francisco, just under the on-ramp to I-280. A group of tents inhabited the space then. The ground around the tents was swept, and bicycles stood in neat lines. Residents such as Jessica Prater knew one another and felt safe there.
You know, I can trust pretty much everyone down here, and if for some reason something does come up missing, somebody has my back. Like, I was a single female out here at one point, you know, and I never had worries. Like, I never carried a knife, I never carried pepper spray or any, you know, personal weapon.
A month ago, flyers went up warning that the encampment would have to move, that Caltrans construction would begin on March 11th. And right on schedule, on Monday of last week, police officers and the city's homeless outreach team put wristbands on the camp residents and helped them load their belongings onto trucks. Then Caltrans workers began drilling holes, putting in posts, and pouring concrete for a new fence to barricade the area from reentry. The people from the 5th and King encampment were told to go to a temporary shelter set up at City of Refuge Church, a little over a mile away on Howard Street. They stayed there for 3 days and 2 nights. The church also had a pop-up service center where former campers could get food and a shower, talk with social workers, and get assessed for housing. I stopped by on Tuesday last week. Because of privacy rules set by the Department of Public Health, I wasn't allowed to talk with the displaced campers inside the shelter, but I could talk with them on the sidewalk outside. Ray Brown, a homeless veteran and unemployed construction worker, lived with his girlfriend under the on-ramp at 5th and King for about 5 months. He told me he was worried the police would arrest some of the group.
We all believed it, you know. They were going to come down there and run names and try to throw us in jail that they could, you know, because that's generally what happens, you know.
And what happened instead?
They loaded our carts and put them in storage and gave us a place to stay and helping us. And we're very happy about that.
Inside the church, the sleeping mats were neatly pushed to one side of the room, with some blankets and pillows lying among them. About 8 tables were set up on the other side. At a few, people were eating sandwiches and chatting. At a table near the front, a woman with a computer was talking intently with one of the homeless clients. The city's homeless outreach team was there to offer assessment and services. The atmosphere was calm, peaceful, even hopeful.
The service we had today, you know, we had mental health here, substance abuse.
Fred Thompson was working as the shelter manager.
What else do we have here? Haircuts, massages, methadone clinic, nurse practitioners.
He said he'd heard a positive response from the newly sheltered.
They're very grateful. You know, they didn't have to sleep outside last night. One of them told me, said, my day started off today better than it did yesterday.
From the makeshift shelter, by Wednesday night, one person went into a more permanent shelter, and 26 were placed in single-room occupancy hotels. James Thomas, who'd been homeless for almost 2 years, told me what getting a room means for him.
I've been doing a lot of work with like catering and PR and whatnot, and getting back into those kind of jobs, it requires me to actually be clean and maintained, and it was hard for me not to be able to do that. Right now, I'm able to just jump right back into that and keep that, and it really makes a big difference.
The move into an SRO comes with some expectations, according to Bevan Dufty, director of HOPE, that is, Housing Opportunity, Partnerships, and Engagement for the City of San Francisco. He says the new residents will work with newly assigned case managers on individual plans.
For some people, they may not have ID. For some people, they may qualify for SSI, disability, and so they should apply to that to have a source of income. For some people, it may be that they have the ability to go to work. For some people, they need treatment.
And, he says, those people have to follow through.
What doesn't work is if somebody shuts himself in a room, doesn't want to meet with someone, doesn't want to be accountable in terms of working on a plan and getting somewhere, that's when you fall into trouble.
The SROs that house the formerly homeless are in the Tenderloin, Chinatown, and South of Market districts. Dufty says those can be challenging environments due to drug use and small crimes in the neighborhoods, so the city considered other factors to counter those obstacles.
The health department focused on trying to group people in the three buildings that they were placed that had friendships and associations so that they would not be separated from their support network, so to speak. And we'll see how that works.
Back at the shelter, Vanessa Romo, who'd been homeless for years, told me she's ready to make a change.
Part of the assessment asked if you would be willing to save up money for permanent housing. So I'm assuming that when we get to the stabilization housing, that we do know there's case managers there on site, but I'm sure the case managers are going to have us do some type of money management plan, which for me is a good thing because I get SSI and I end up blowing off my check and having my whole check gone within 6 days, sometimes five.
Despite the general mood of optimism, at least one person I met was upset. I found Brian Georgie, homeless for 5 years, sitting on the curb outside the City of Refuge Church.
And they told me that they can't help me. They don't have enough rooms. But down there, they told us that they had a room for each and every person.
Georgie lifted his cap to reveal hair cropped close to his skull.
The only thing that they've offered us is a haircut.
Because of epilepsy, Georgie has a therapy animal, a pit bull he's raised since she was a puppy. He used to have a case manager through the homeless outreach team. But when he went to Washington for a family emergency and missed an appointment, he said, his case was closed. He lost his former SRO room. Now he's back to square one.
It seems to me that they're playing a favoritism role here with those that they've never encountered before, compared to those that they already know that have problems.
HOPE Director Bevan Dufty says they're trying to get to everyone. Andy says that setting up a shelter in which to house a group temporarily before offering transitional housing may prove to be a useful model.
My phone's already ringing and my emails are coming in from people with suggestions. Certainly one of the reasons we prioritize this area is because there were a large number of people there. I definitely think that of the neighborhood, South of Market is the most affected area, but there are definitely other parts of our city that have chronic homelessness.
On my way home, I see that for myself. Near the corner of 5th and Bryant, I see grocery carts, sleeping bags, bundles of clothing, people napping in the shade. One bright-faced woman holds out a cup by the roadside. The new fence near the Caltrain terminus might have disrupted the cycle of homelessness for some people, but many others still wait for help. In San Francisco, I'm Mary Reese for CrossCurrents.
And if you have solutions for housing homeless people, you can add your thoughts at our Facebook page. We're KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Last week, we aired a commentary by Richard Gilliam, who's an inmate at the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. Here's an excerpt of what we broadcast as read by KALW's Chris Hoff.
As of March 1st, I will have 38 days remaining to serve until my parole date, yet I have not signed my parole conditions. nor do I know the parole office I am to report to. And, most importantly, I have no idea where I'll be staying once I re-enter the community.
After that aired, we asked the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitations for a reply. Here's what Public Information Officer Bill Sessa had to say.
Well, in the first place, he has been notified of who his parole agent will be, and he was notified a good 8 days before he wrote that letter. And we had discussed his parole conditions since last October, so there is no mystery there either. The formality of actually signing the conditions usually is done on the day that he reports to his parole agent.
And so how did you find this information out? How do we know that Richard is not telling the truth?
Well, I did talk to the case manager inside the prison where Mr. Gilliam is being held. I also talked to a regional director for parole. I talked to the parole agent who is going to be expecting him when he's released. And I also talked to headquarters staff. And all of those conversations were independent of one another. So none of the people that I was talking to knew of the other people that I was asking questions of.
Okay, so I'm going to go to Mr. Gilliam's second allegation. It says,
the Department of Corrections Operations Manual, section on release procedures and conditions of parole, articulates procedures regarding imminent paroles. Among those regulations, it says, CDC policy requires referrals to be forwarded to the regional reentry coordinator 210 days prior to the earliest possible release date. My release date has been the same for more than a year, so this notification should already have happened as of October of last year.
Well, I think that what that gives us is a maximum amount of time that we do these case studies. We have some inmates that have much more severe needs than others. We typically would be producing a plan like that very early on if we had to get someone into a residential treatment program for substance abuse or for mental health treatment. But it is very routine for us to be talking with inmates about their reentry plans about the same time as we've been talking to Mr. Gilliam. There is really nothing extraordinary here. It's a very straightforward case, and everything that he needs to know by the time he goes out the door, he already knows, and he knew it before he wrote the letter to you.
So you're essentially saying that Mr. Gilliam is not being truthful?
Essentially, that is exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, I'm going to go through his third allegation.
After this notification, a parole agent is assigned. He or she is supposed to investigate any proposed residence program to determine if it is suitable for the parolee to live in. The parole agent is also required to investigate any employment, training, or school plans to determine the validity of any job offer, whether it's appropriate, and so on and so forth. If there's not enough information available for the parole agent to make an adequate assessment, he is supposed to contact the inmate to request information about alternative residence or employment plans if the proposed program is unsatisfactory. Since I gave no prospective residence or employment information when asked, the assigned parole agent, by regulation, should have contacted me by now. He or she has not.
That is true, except that the most important part of his comment is he did not offer up either a job referral or an address. It is very common for us to have parolees who are registered as transient if they do not have an address. I think the implication is that we are supposed to find him a job and a place to live. We don't do either one. What we do is verify or validate the information that the parolee gives us so that they can't just fake an address or fake of the potential of a job when they don't have one. But in this case, since he offered up no information, there was nothing to check on.
I've done my part. I've researched transitional housing options and educational opportunities. But without any assistance or recognition from parole representatives, I have no idea if these resources are available. With this deliberate indifference to my and every other parolee's plight, is it any wonder why the recidivism rate among California's parolees is so high?
What he seems to be saying here is he's trying to research these options, but he doesn't have a way to pick up the phone and call and find out if there's space. He seems to be saying, why am I not having some assistance with this?
That is something typically that a parole agent will do when the parolee is assigned to them. And he does have a parole agent that he will be reporting to. And part of that agent's job is to help him through all the things that he's talking about now.
So let's move from the specifics of Gilliam's case and really talk about the larger issue here, which is that California is paroling a large number of people each year, and they go back into the communities. And I guess the essential complaint here is there a lack of resources for successful reentry, and is that why California and the fact that there may not be, is that the reason that California's recidivism rate is so high?
Well, let me take the first part of that question, because recidivism has many different factors to it, and the availability of services might be one factor, but there are many others. But as far as whether or not there are enough services, I can tell you that we're constantly expanding our parole services. We've had a new infusion of funds to make up for some budget cuts of a few years ago. And much of that money is being spent on things like day reporting centers, places where parolees can go to during the day. They're not residential programs, where they can use a computer, where they can get job referrals, where they can hook up with Social Security to get a driver's license, to get referrals for social service agencies where they need some help. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's easy. We're just doing everything we can to accommodate them and give the parolee everything that we can offer to make that transition more smooth.
That's Bill Sessa, who's a public information officer with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And just a note to our listeners, we have a reporter working on trying to get at the bottom of this about the question of whether or not the CDCR is providing more programs and reentry services for inmates and why so many inmates are saying they're not seeing this. So we'll have that story for you later this month or next month. And in the meantime, we'd like to hear your feedback about this or any of our other stories. You can keep the voicemails coming by calling 415-264-7106. You can leave us a message with your feedback at 415-264-7106. And you can also alert us to stories we should be covering. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Oftentimes, spiritual leaders are the ones we turn to help solve problems in our communities. One of those leaders is Reverend George Cummings of the Imani Community Church in Oakland. For years, he's been working with local community members to reduce the violence in East Oakland. Recently, neighborhood advocates like Cummings have teamed up with the Oakland Police Department to implement a violence prevention program called Ceasefire. I asked Reverend Cummings to explain how it works.
Essentially, what the model does is, first of all, identifies who the drivers of violence are and then provides them with an opportunity through the call-ins to hear from the community, law enforcement, and social service providers who deliver one simple message. We want you to stop the shooting, and if you want to get out of the life, we will help you to begin to transform your life in a different direction.
So paint a picture of one of these call-ins for me.
So call-in is based on an invitation to about 30, generally speaking, about 30 people. The last call-in we had in Oakland was in October. We had 22 people. We sit in a circle. There are representatives of the community, faith representatives, sometimes mothers, grandmothers.
Each
victims.
One of these guys that's being called in is asked to bring somebody important with them, right?
Right, right. A girlfriend, a wife, a sister, a mother. And then we sit in a circle. There's law enforcement, there's social service providers, there are community members, and then the young men are there. So it's a circle of maybe 40 or 50 people.
And what do you say?
And then we give them the message. The message is that we care about you. You're a part of our community. We're concerned about your future. We want you to stay alive, and we want you to stay free. We don't want you to end up in prison. And therefore, we want you to stop shooting. We want you to put the guns down. Now, we understand that there are many other things that shape your life, but we want you to stop shooting because your shooting does not affect you or not just the people that you're in relationship to in the streets, but it affects children. It affects your parents. It affects the safety of all family members that you're connected to and the whole community, and we want you to stop it.
And so how did these 22 guys, the guys that are considered probably the most scary people in Oakland, how did they react to this message?
Well, many of them listened. We had 22 in the room. Out of the 22, 11 signed up that day for services. And to date, I think we have 7 who are still in the process receiving services from social service providers.
What kind of services are
sometimes it's as simple as I need a place to stay. Many of them need employment because selling drugs and being involved with the gangs is a way of making a living. And so and employment means retraining. Sometimes they need to get their GED. We've found some instances where there's need for mental health counseling, but those are the kinds of resources that are often needed. And then many of them need to be mentored, and somebody needs to walk with them through the process.
And so are there mentors?
Well, we have discovered that we've got to ramp up the volume on mentors. There are a number of programs in Oakland, not always connected to the ceasefire model, but part of what we're trying to do is to find those resources and identify them. One of the big mentoring programs, a couple of programs are in 2 churches in East Oakland that have provided an opportunity for people who are coming back from prison to kind of have someone to guide them and show them how to become more productive parts of the community.
And so you're talking about the ceasefire that's being implemented right now in Oakland. You feel like you're seeing it actually have an effect. You were part of a group in 2006, 2007 that tried to implement ceasefire here in Oakland, but it didn't work. Can you explain what's the difference?
Well, the ceasefire model works at its best when you have commitment from all some key collaborators. And I would say that in the previous iterations of ceasefire in Oakland, there were at least 2 times we tried to implement it. There was commitment from some of those sectors, but not all of the sectors. And the model has to be implemented comprehensively. So if you don't have OPD committed to community policing and the training that's necessary to get all the officers moving in that direction, if you don't have a commitment from the mayor's office and the city administrator's office to provide resources and to hire a project manager to drive the ceasefire model, if you don't have the kind of support and trust from community members who are willing to work with OPD, if you don't have those things in convergence with each other, you're probably not going to have success with the ceasefire model. One of the things that we like about what's been happening over the last 5 months in Oakland is that all of those parties are in place. People are tired of the violence in Oakland. We had 131 homicides in Oakland last year and are committed in general to working in the same direction. The chief of police is committed. The mayor is committed. The head of probation is committed. And so at our kickoff event at Allen Temple Baptist Church in April, in September, all of those parties were represented. And then you had the community. And we spoke together in one voice to say, public safety is important, violence must stop, and we are committed to working together.
What do you think has changed?
Well, I think the urgency maybe of the moment. Everybody in Oakland, in general, I mean, I would say everybody in Oakland believes that public safety is at the top of the list. For what, I mean, we like living in Oakland. But safety is important. And so I think people have a greater sense of urgency of the impact of gun violence on their communities and their neighborhoods.
David Kennedy, the guy who piloted the ceasefire model originally in Boston and then took it around the country, he says that a lot of the problem with our perception of public safety and what actually leads to people being safe is wrong, that we have these misconceptions about who's committing the violence and who's allowing it to happen and what crime means. Do you agree with that? Can you elaborate?
I agree with David for the most part. I think the general perception that I would say of violence in America is that it's perpetrated by people in dangerous neighborhoods, ghettos, dangerous communities. And I don't think that's right. I think that we have to talk about violence as being endemic to America as a nation, and we don't like to talk about that violence has been deeply embedded in the history of America, and so that's one issue. Secondly, I think the general conception is that, for example, last year, the one station, the Discovery Channel, did a piece on Oakland and claimed that there were thousands and thousands of gang members and they're all involved in violence. Well, that's not really the case in Oakland. The general perception is that everybody in the community is in these neighborhoods are willing to let this violence go on. That is not the case. There is fear involved while people don't come forward. People are concerned about what will happen to them and their families if they give information to police department about what they see. And then, of course, I mean, there's just general uncertainty and suspicion of police and law enforcement. I have tried to point out consistently that one of the deepest issues as it relates to the African-American community is that law enforcement, historically, going all the way back to slavery times, did not mean anything good for black people. And so when black people think of law enforcement, they are thinking about the enemy, not somebody who's working on their behalf. And we have to turn that around on both sides.
Is that happening?
We're making progress. I know that last year and the year before, there are about 40 congregations, for example, that had Honor Your Officer Sunday, where we acknowledged that police officers are an important part of keeping safety in our community, and we acknowledged that they're human beings too. And they come and they share a meal in the church, but it's an attempt to begin to change the attitude of communities towards law enforcement.
Reverend George Cummings is pastor of the Imani Community Church in Oakland, and he's co-chair of the Oakland Ceasefire Community Working Group. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about Ceasefire, which is a violence prevention project that is being implemented right now in Oakland. So what's next for Ceasefire, Reverend Cummings?
Well, so in Oakland, we're about 5 months into the project, and we are hoping that some of the preliminary results that we are seeing. We have seen an 18% reduction in homicide in the neighborhoods that have been targeted. And across the city, we've seen a 45% reduction in both homicides and shootings for the first 2 months of the year. So we're hoping that will continue. We also know that in the summer months, once the evening hours become more changes, very often violent activity increases. We are moving towards our second call-in later this month, and we plan to have an event in April that will provide some data to say, here's what's changed. This is what the trends we see. We don't want to draw conclusions based on 6 months, but we think we can see some things beginning to trend in the other direction.
And what do you say to the critics of the ceasefire model? There's those from the social service providers side that often say, well, you're not addressing the root causes of violence, which is oftentimes poverty and lack of educational opportunity, et cetera, jobs.
So let's take that side, and then we'll take the kind of tough on crime.
Sure. So the long term, the focus of the ceasefire model is reducing violence, and we really do have to be think about it that specifically and that clearly, so that to the extent that we are able to reduce violence in the city of Oakland. The fact of the matter is that in every city where the ceasefire model has been properly implemented, it has led to the reduction of violence. In the city of Richmond, they have had 75% reduction in violence. You've heard, well, we know that in Salinas, in Oxnard, in Sacramento, in a number of places in California, but also across the country, the ceasefire model has been implemented, and it has led to from anywhere from 60 to 80% reduction in violence. So one of the things I say to the critics is that it works to the extent that it reduces violence. Now, it doesn't address all of the issues, and it is not designed to address all of the issues. But and we certainly have, as a society, to begin to think about how we address all those issues. And there are lots of clues. I mean, if we spend a lot of money, and we do, on mass incarceration, if we can simply redirect some of those resources to prevention, I think we can make a big difference. But we've got to begin to think together as a society. We have to begin to think about the question of marijuana. I mean, does somebody really need to go to jail for selling an ounce of marijuana? I mean, and that raises the whole question of legalization of marijuana in the state of California. We've been talking about that, and we've been talking about it nationally. And there are solutions from across the water in Europe that suggest that maybe we need to think about this differently. So there are many things we need to think about differently. So I respond to the critics by saying it works, and we have to continue then to work at the other pieces of it.
And what do you say to the critics who are from the kind of tough on crime perspective, which is, hey, you have these known criminals in the room and you're saying we're not going to lock you up. How dare you?
Well, the fact of the matter is that carpet bombing neighborhoods and sending people to prison in the long run simply grows the population in prison and does not fundamentally address the issue of how to stop violence in our communities. I think it's perfectly normal to be concerned that people who are hardened criminals and who are will continue to shoot are people that you ought to think about whether or not you want to put them in prison. And in the ceasefire model, we have encountered people who we think ought to go to prison. If you don't get the message that you need to stop shooting and you continue to do that and continue to kill, and there's lots of examples where that is in fact the case, then those people need to be incarcerated and taken out of the population because they simply will not get the message. But there are lots of others who do get the message, and those are the ones we try to work with.
And what the ceasefire model has found is that it's just a few people who are committing the violence, and most of them don't actually want to be doing it either.
Absolutely. What we found when Harvard did a study, actually a study of violence in urban settings, and contrary to the popular perception, they discovered that it's a relatively small group of people who are the shooters or the shot callers. And you need to focus on those people if you want to stop violence. Get them out of the equation. Now, we have also learned that there are always people who will step up after them, wannabes who see this lifestyle as something that they want to be engaged in. So we also have to begin to address those groups. But I think we can address the issue of reducing violence in cities if we can begin to get the folk who drive it out of the equation.
That's the Reverend George Cummings, who's pastor of the Imani Community Church in Oakland and co-chair of the Oakland Ceasefire Community Working Group. Is there someone in your neighborhood who inspires you? You can tell us about them in the comments section at our website, which is also where you can hear this interview and all of our stories. It's kalw.org.
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Laura Sapinara, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, Raisu Sussman, Stephen Short, and Melanie Young. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor, our managing editor is Martina Castro, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you. We are independent, local, community-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear from the man behind the sounds of the Barbary Coast Show at the San Francisco Conservatory of Flowers.
Because usually by the end of each show, everything you see in this room is broken except for the sound. The trains stop running, the lighting's all dead, the cockroaches have eaten through something, all the glue's fallen off, but the sound keeps going.
The sounds of Gold Rush San Francisco in a room full of plants. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. You're listening to the Latin rhythms of Bay Area musician John Santos, author of our Cross Currents theme music. Santos is resident artistic director for 4 performances at the new SF Jazz Center this weekend, and he'll be performing on Saturday starting at 7:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.